Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. The Man Booker Prize aims to promote the finest in fiction by rewarding the best novel of the year written in English and published in the United Kingdom. The winner receives a large cash prize, and along with the other five shortlisted authors out of an original 155 novels, enjoys a dramatic increase in book sales worldwide. In 2014, the rules of the prize were changed to extend eligibility to any novel written in English, meaning that American authors could enter for the first time. And my guest today has become the first American to win under the new rules. He's a Los Angeles-born author who was originally a poet. He's written satire and performed on television. He's put together a comedic anthology and studied psychology. And now his latest book, The Sellout, which has already won the National Book Critics Circle Award, has been given the highest UK literary honour. This interview was recorded the day before he won the Man Booker Prize. Paul Beattie, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, you're from Los Angeles originally, so tell me about your first literary influences. Was it a big reading household?
Yeah, no, my mom read a lot, and me and my sisters all read what she read, but she had a very good library, which I think about a long time, and I kind of write about it every now and then, not so much in this book, but I have very distinct memories of just her reading The New Yorker, and for me, there's a thing about how the thickness of those pages have changed and the size of the magazine. Anyways, but I can remember the crinkle of those pages turning when she used to read The New Yorker, and she still reads a ton. She probably reads the most out of all of us, but all of us read.
And in terms of fiction?
Fiction. I mean, we read what she had on the shelf. So Sal Bellow, Gore Vidal, Joseph Heller, you know, that's the kind of stuff she read. And, yeah, my sisters read the religion books. I didn't read those. And we all read. She was a nurse, so she had a ton of medical books, too. But yeah, we read what was on her shelf.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first discover poetry then?
I used to have to write a poem in school, I guess, every now and then. You know, they'd give you some poems out of the Norton Anthology to read. And so I guess that's first. But I guess when I turned around 20, maybe, I started going to, I was in Boston, and I started going to used bookstores, and for some reason I was drawn to the poetry section. So I'd buy, you know, I mean, I think the first book of poetry I bought was an E. E. Cummings, probably Selected Poems, I guess. Now that I think about it, I was like, the guy who doesn't use capitals. And so I read those, and I would just, you know, buy whatever struck my fancy.
And 1990, of course, was your big breakthrough in poetry. Tell me what happened then.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a breakthrough, but yeah, I mean, I used to just kind of read my poems. And there was a place called the New Eureka Poets Cafe that I would read at every now and then. I guess I'd read there, St. Mark's Poetry Project in the East Village. And then they had a thing called the Slam, which thankfully wasn't what it is now. Kind of people just read, you know, it wasn't like such a big deal. And it wasn't performative. I mean, I'm not performative at all. But I read and I won this thing. But even prior to that, a woman named Evelyn McDonald did like a little profile on me in the Village Voice. She'd seen me read at St. Mark's Poetry Project. So, but I mean, the thing that really helped out of the New Yorker was Guy Bob and his wife, Elizabeth Murray, the painter. She's passed away now. But they helped publish my first book of poems, called Big Bank Take Little Bank, and that was huge. That was, I'm deeply appreciative to them for that. And me and a guy named Mike Tyler. Shout out to Mike. If anyone would hear this, he would. But we just kind of gathered around the computer, me, him, and his girlfriend at the time, Silver. We just kind of put the book together, and that for me was a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. You say that you're not a performer, but you have done poetry on television.
Yeah, I mean, people read on, you know, John Berryman was reading on television, so maybe he was performing, actually. I'm just reading, and I'm kind of a pain in the ass because they want you to memorize it, and I refuse. So, you know, I just have my piece of paper. I just hold on to it like a security blanket.
So doesn't your own work stay in your head?
No, not at all. I mean, it's long, and I don't have a good memory anyways, but yeah. It doesn't at all.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder about a market for poetry. I know here in Britain it's really difficult to get poetry books reviewed. It's really hard to find the market, really. Is that different in the States?
I mean, I can't say if it's different or not. I'm not going to speak to the poetry scene here. I don't really know. But poetry is its own universe a little bit. You know, at the time, it's funny, you know, I teach and every now and then I'll talk to the students. And when I first started writing poetry in New York, there was a thing called the Poetry Calendar, which they would issue every month. And it was this big kind of broadsheet. It was huge. And you would stop by St. Mark's Books or something, or it would be all over, of just poetry readings, mostly in Manhattan, but all throughout the city. And there were so many things. I mean, it was really nuts. And I don't know if it's the same now. I don't pay attention as much, so I can't speak to a difference, really.
Yeah.
But I think they're avenues. I mean, I think, you know, poets are going to do their thing, you know, no matter where they are. And I think most places have a poetry scene, you know, in terms of size or dynamism. I don't know. But, people write poems. You know, I think more people are writing poems probably than ever before. More people are writing than ever before.
Yeah.
That's good and bad.
Let's talk about education, because I know that you studied both creative writing and psychology. Mm. What was the timeline of that?
Yeah, so I guess in the mid-80s, I was getting my doctorate in psych in Boston. And I was like 3 years in. And, you know, I just was reading more. I was reading poetry, going to poetry readings every now and then, and reading differently, I guess. And I don't know if disillusioned is too strong of a word for my sense in psych, but I had been in Boston too long, I think. And at some level, it just dawned on me that I wanted to be a writer. I needed to get out of Boston. And it just dawned on me that I wanted to be a writer. And I love doing psych, and I've learned so much about from it. And it's taught me a ton about myself, about the world. But I just realized it wasn't what I wanted to do 9 to 5, I think. So I hadn't really written anything. And I just kind of, all I knew how to do was go to school at that point. So I found out there were these things called MFAs in poetry, which I had no idea. Yeah, I don't know how many programs there were. There weren't a ton then. And I was just determined I was either going to California or to New York. You know, I hated New York, but... And I ended up getting into Brooklyn College, even though I hadn't written anything. I kind of just scribbled out some poems and sent them and showed up in Brooklyn. And yeah, that's how it worked pretty much.
And do you think that you can be taught to be a writer?
Can you be taught to be a writer? No, I don't think so. I don't think you can be taught to be a writer. I think you can be taught maybe, or you can be guided into whether or not you want to be a writer, I think. And I think... Yeah, can you be taught to be a writer? No, that sounds like teaching a dog how to sit or something. But so I don't think, but I think, you know, what I can speak for myself, I mean, I learned a lot about how I write, how I want to write from going to school. You know, that took a long time to figure out. But I knew that I wanted to be a writer, you know, and I think some people show up and go, ah, this isn't for me. And I showed up and I was like, yeah, this is what I wanted to do. And I mean, it was the simple things. And, you know, I learned about the discipline, you know. For me, it's not just in that environment, but for me, I'm always struck when I go, oh, I didn't know you could do that. And so I was brand new. And so, you know, I would sit down in class and everyone was at a different, they were where they were. I mean, there were published poets and poets who had books. And so I was surprised by that. But, you know, I just learned from things that people were doing. I was just, oh, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could do that. Okay, that's how, if I want to format something this way, that's that. You know, so that stuff was very valuable to me. But it wasn't stuff that I was doing. But for me, anytime I see somebody else do something I didn't know could be done, that just broadens my mind a little bit. I don't necessarily do what they do, but it just like just gets me thinking more creatively, mm-hmm, I think. Mm-hmm. So,
and then that switch from poet to novelist, The White Boy Shuffle, that was your first novel.
It was.
It was described as falling under new genres of new black aesthetic and post-soul aesthetic. And yeah. I wondered if you could explain those terms to me.
Yeah, you'd have to ask somebody about those. I don't use those. I mean, I think I just write the way I write. And I think, you know, I think those terms, I understand them, I guess. And I sort of understand the need for them, I think. But I try not to fall in the trap of just reinventing blackness every 10 years. It just doesn't make any sense to me, yeah, to be honest. And, you know, I'm just writing. You know, there are people before me, people after me. And, yeah, that's going to continue. But, you know, I think there's something about, it's kind of a pain in the ass because, I guess maybe there are other demographic arts that just need to be relabeled every few years. But... So it's a pain in the ass to think about it, to be honest, but it gives me something to kind of write, not against necessarily, but just another thing to poke fun at, like that level of thinking.
I mean, labels are important, for instance, and I'm thinking here just of poet and author, yeah. and where those two come together and, sure. and how you define yourself now.
I just, anybody asks, I'll just say I'm a writer. You know, I had a hard time saying I was a poet. So that was a tough one for me. I'm not sure why. Yeah, I wasn't ashamed of it or anything. I wasn't comfortable with it somehow. You know, in poetry, I mean, I learned to write. We were talking about White Boy Shuffle, and, you know, that was a book that even while I was writing poetry, I was thinking about for a long time and taking all these notes, and I had this shoebox full of notes. I didn't know what a novel was, really. At least didn't, you know, what a novel meant for me to write one, I guess. Mm. You know, I was writing these long, 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 long poems, 30 pages, you know, 25 pages, sometimes a little longer. And I just didn't know how to do it, but some people had asked me to write some essays. And I wrote an essay, which was very autobiographical, about Generation X, even though I wasn't Generation X. And I kind of, it's not what the essay's about, but it starts off with a trip that I had taken back to Los Angeles, me and my friends, Ronald and Al, going to buy some beer. And I just did this big, broad kind of essay. It has charts in it, and a museum actually used that essay as an installation once. Oh. Yeah, it was pretty cool, actually. But in the same way that the museum did that, it taught me that I can kind of do anything on the page, that I could actually write a sentence. And as soon as I had written that essay, I knew what that book was going to be. Like, I was like, oh, okay, that's how you... I just knew what it sounded like. I knew it was going to be set. And that was a huge thing for me. And, you know, in writing that book, the process for me isn't so dissimilar from writing poetry or from writing prose, but there was a satisfaction there that that I'm still feeding off to this day. And I remember a friend telling me, not so long ago actually, he was like, yeah, this poet who's actually fairly well known, she's pretty famous, she was like, she's so upset that you're not writing poems anymore, blah blah blah, you're a better poet than you were a novelist. I don't think that's true, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is, but
but certainly your books. I mean, this book. I mean, it's funny. It's dark. It's a satire, but also it's poetry.
I guess in parts. I mean, it's you know, I try to take every word pretty seriously. You know, I think about every word that's in there more or less. And I mean, it's when we were talking about process a little. Yeah, the process is not so different for me. I mean, it was hard for me to write poems. I didn't write very many of them. I probably wrote 30 poems total, maybe a couple more. I don't know. Not very many, but yeah, it's hard. And the poetry is the skeleton for everything. I mean, 'cause it's about language for me. Language drives everything for me. You know?
Speaking of language, I understand that you don't like the term African-American.
That's not, I don't like it. I don't use it particularly. Yeah. But yeah, it's just not comfortable. It's not a term I grew up using. You know, I was black. Some people on TV were black. Some of my friends were black. My mom is black. My sisters are black, you know. It's not, I don't have like a big thing against the term. It just doesn't roll off my tongue very well.
Sure. Well, I want to come back to that a little bit later, because of course that there are other words, contentious words that come up in the sellout. But before we get there, your book Tough again touches on some of the themes that we've seen before, and indeed we'll see again. Just tell me a little bit about that.
I think if there's a guiding thing to my books, it's just these solitary guys trying to do the impossible. And trying to break out about, you know, this notion of what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to do things. And within that framework, I can go anywhere, I think, and I try to let them go anywhere. Tough's a book about a chubby kid. I guess he's more chubby in East Harlem, who ends up running for city council, you know, because he realizes politicians don't have any skills. He doesn't have any skills, so maybe it's something he can do. He has a woman who's actually based on a person I knew who I really admired a lot, who's a Japanese American, who kind of helps guides him along and, you know, keeps him grounded a little bit and just sort of points him in the right direction to get done what he needs to get done, even though he doesn't really do it. But yeah, that's a special book for me. That was a hard book to write. It's the one book that I've written that's set in New York, which is a place, even though I've lived there a long time, I'm not very comfortable with the landscape, but I think I was able to get the sound of New York in that book a little. And he's a great character, I think. And there's some things, I actually had a meeting with a movie exec the other day. And in the book, he talks about like how movies will become marketing, like the line is going to blur. In the States, there's a cereal called Cap'n Crunch. I don't know if it exists here, probably not. But he talks about how there's going to be Cap'n Crunch the movie. And so I met with this exec a couple of months ago, and he remembers reading this line. He was like, this is going to happen. This is... So I saw him, and he's still like, he's kind of proud that he predicted it along with the book. But it's a line that I stole from my friend Charlie. So anyway.
We move on to Slumberland. We wrote that in 2008. Mm. Again, it's about, I suppose, debunking racial myths.
Yeah, not racial myths. I think a lot of myths. It's not just not race. I mean, you know, this is a guy who's trying to rebuild the Berlin Wall and ends up kind of doing it. So, so it's beyond racial myths. And, you know, that's a book. I lived in Berlin for a little while. I just, for me, there were some funny similarities between being German and being black and being East German and being black, you know, some of them facetious, but something there. And so, yeah, that was, I'd always said I was never going to write about my time in Germany. But I found myself taking notes, and I had this real thick moleskin book full of notes that I lost on the plane. And then when I lost it, I realized how important all that stuff was to me, and I never found it. But it forced me to kind of rethink everything. And, you know, I spent the next couple of years kind of redoing those notes, you know, just the notes. Slumberland was a hard, hard book to write. I ended up kind of cobbling those notes into 50 pages of something that sounded like poetry, but didn't make much sense. And I showed it to my agent, and she ended up shopping it way too early. I hope she never hears this. But and no one quite got it, which is understandable, except one guy, Colin Dickerman, who's my editor now, and he just looked at it and we sat down. He just told me to just tell the story. And as soon as he said that, that made perfect sense. And I was like, oh, yeah, this goes in the middle. This goes at the end. And so Slumberland's a tough book, but it's a book that I really love, I have to say. Sorry about that.
Heron Fleet came next.
That's not my book. I don't know. That's that's some other Paul Beatty. I have no idea
really?
Who that is. Yeah.
How bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't have to talk about that.
We could talk about it. You might know something about it that I don't know.
How odd. In everything I've read, it has Heron Fleet there.
Really? Yeah. I know it's on Amazon.
Have you read it?
No, I have no interest in it.
Maybe it's really good and you could claim it anyway.
Yeah, I saw it. It's funny. I was looking on Amazon, I guess, and I think it's like a thing on Amazon where somebody's like writing, who is this guy? Like he could at least add a middle initial to his name and stop trying to, you know, take my, but so, yeah.
Well, we come to Sell Out now, which is, of course, this wonderful book nominated for the Booker, which brings so many of these big themes together. And we were talking about contentious labels. So the use of the word nigger, which I'm really reluctant to even say. But as you point out in the book, your unnamed protagonist says, Mark Twain, obviously writing in a different age with different sensibilities, wasn't reluctant to use the word. In fact, used it 219 times or 68 times per page.
Mm.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know if it's 68 times per page, but, you know, it's a pejorative for him in another sense. It's a label, you know. I think he used it in the same way some people use him, African-American, in the same way. It's just those people.
Yeah.
To whatever degree people think that black people are people.
Your main character says that, in fact, he has a greater hatred for words ending in S, E-double-S.
Yeah. Him, I mean, for this character is kind of, I think he's trying to be sensitive to a lot of things. And for him, castigation is just not about that word. It's about a lot of words. And he says these words, Jewish actress. I think the word he hates most is giantess or something, which is this kind of very evil word. Yeah, he's also doing it just to poke fun at those guys because he knows it's going to stick in their craw a little bit, which it does.
Mm-hmm. Your great character, Marpessa, works on a bus, and you write about how calling someone a nigger in different neighborhoods, the kind of neighborhoods she drives through, leads to different results. I found that fascinating.
Mm.
You use it in one area and you'll get punched in another. It's a completely different reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true with a lot of words, I think, you know. And, you know, most groups have their words that they use. And, yeah, I don't know if it's about, I mean, you know, the common trope is or the... You know, it's like about taking power of those words, you know, and I think there's some truth to that. You know, I'm not sure why I do it. I mean, I think with that word, with nigger, I mean, I read, it must have been my early to mid-20s, I guess. And I read all these slave narratives. The WPA in the 30s and 40s hired artists, you know, out-of-work writers to take these oral histories from people who were slaves. You know, they were dying out. And it's beautiful work. And, I mean, one of the many things that struck me was how I was going to say endemic, but that word is just such a linchpin in how these people see themselves and how other people see them. And it was just, for me, really interesting the way they used it. And so old, and the usage is still so modern. So it just, I don't know, that really flipped me out. And it just struck me how powerful that word has been as an oppressive word. And it was just interesting. You could tell by how they used the word, when they used the word, you could tell who they were talking to, you know, because you could tell the race of the person they were talking to. But just really struck me just how powerful that word is and how it's just not going anywhere. It's, you know, it's just entrenched in our thought process. And it's tied to class. It's tied to a lot of things. Mm.
Is it more offensive saying the N-word?
Yeah, for some people, I guess. I don't say the N-word necessarily. It's not like I go around banding about, you know, saying nigger for other sentence. But N-words, it's a word, you know. And I did a reading for some school kids in Detroit. Packed auditorium, and one kid asked me, he goes, yeah, I want to talk about this word. How come you spell it this way? That's something that I've thought about in a long time. I don't use it all the time, but I use it when it's appropriate. It's a word I used in my poetry every now and then. And I used to spell it one way. And then I realized it's a word. It's weird for a word to be, I mean, words are symbols at some level, you know, they represent something. But I like made a decision, like if I'm going to use it, I'm spelling it, you know, the way it's in the dictionary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can remember, like, I've only been in one fight in my life, really. And it was when a kid called me a nigger, and I don't know, I must have been in second grade or something. And I didn't really know what the word meant. It's a word that shapes how you see yourself at some level in different things, you know. And so for me, I mean, I don't want to talk about this word all day, but I think of things where that word has meant things to me, depending on who said it. I had a friend, my friend Toy Russell, who used the word, and he was the first person who would use the word for other ethnicities. You know, it didn't matter. Everybody was that to him.
Yeah.
And I remember my friend Maurice pointing that out about how Toy used it. And I was like, oh, shit, yeah. And then, you know, it's a word that carries a lot of power, you know, and it's for everybody. And so that strikes me, you know, and that's one of the things, German and black, those are words that have weight to them, that have heft to them.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Los Angeles, obviously, and you talk about LA newcomers. There's a wonderful kind of riff that you write about LA newcomers and suddenly realizing that it isn't all Bret Easton Ellis out there. And I just wonder who else, apart from you, obviously, captures the real soul of LA. I mean, is LA James Ellroy? Is it Bret Easton Ellis? Is it even Jackie Collins?
Yeah, I mean, it's different for different people. You know, LA's a big place, and it's a place where you kind of have your little sluiceways to get from where you get, and you don't really see anything else, you know. My LA is not the LA, you know. My LA is the LA that I know, not that I know necessarily, the LA that I want it to be and the LA that I make up, you know. Yeah. And I try to write about an LA that I don't know sometimes, and, you know, like in the book is an LA that I don't really know, but I really want to figure out. It's not like a place that really exists. So, I mean, LA's all these things, and I think, you know, people, like many big cities like London, I'm sure it's like a place where people run to for different reasons, you know, or running away or run to, you know, and they just, you end up there. But LA has a place, you know, it's this place of dreams. It's still a frontier. LA's always changing. And it's a place that I don't really know anymore. You know, I haven't lived there in a long time, but it's the ground there, you know, the territory there is, because I'm familiar with it, you know, in my head. So it's a good place for me to just work out all the things that I'm thinking about, you know, and, so it's a place that I go back to all the time. And it's interesting, you know, James Ellroy, Bret Easton Ellis, Jackie Collins, whoever. I haven't read, maybe I have read a Jackie Collins book actually a long time
ago. Or Ryan Gatiss. I mean, yeah, In It Together is such a...
Yeah, me and my mom used to love these Joseph Wambaugh books, these cop versions of L.A. And they're all patently false in a weird way because, you know, they are what they want. You know, it's an L.A. that they want it to be, but it's an L.A. that's also... It's not very inclusive, and it's only inclusive when it meets its needs, which is, that bothers me, you know, because it's such a beautifully multicultural place, and it's not a place where you have to necessarily force feed that, but it's, yeah, I just try to render an LA that feels fun to me, I guess is the word for me.
Well, of course, your protagonist is trying to recreate his community, but at the same time, he seems very conflicted. Community versus equals leper colony.
Yeah, I mean, because he understands, you know, the sense of drawing a boundary around his community. And, you know, it's a line that's been erased for a reason, I guess. There's a beautiful scene in a movie called Papillon, I don't know if you've ever seen it, Steve McQueen. He's an escapee from a penal colony. He's willing to get out of this community, you know, this prison. And he goes, and the only place he can get refuge is amongst the leper colony. And for me, I don't know, that's probably where that image comes from, I guess, and if I think about it. And, you know, for him to show allegiance, you know, because they're like, yeah, we're lepers, but who the fuck are you? You know, we're us. This is, you know, we have our boundaries. You've crossed those. And for him to show his, not allegiance is too strong of a word, but, you know, his willingness. Is he, you know, this leper who's completely, you know, pustules the whole thing, and he's smoking a cigar, and McQueen takes the cigar out of his mouth and smokes the cigar, you know. And that's always been a very powerful image for me about what people are willing to do. And it says a lot to how I think about community. Yeah, I mean, that's probably why I use that phrase in there, because, you know, that's something, that's a scene that's been in my head and just, for me, very moving. Mm-hmm. And it says to me about what people are willing to do when they cross their borders or don't cross their borders. Mm-hmm. And L.A. is a place with a ton of borders, you know. Sometimes there's signage, a lot of times there isn't signage, you know, and it's... And one of the interesting things that the book tries to tease out is about how we sometimes self-segregate. No one tells us to do this or no one forces us to do that, but, you know, we end up doing it ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like, we know where we're supposed to go and where we're not supposed to go sometimes.
The book is political in many ways. It's funny. It's a really funny book. It's satirical. The humor, I just wonder where your kind of humor influences come from. I know that there's a lot of reference to early television, for instance, in the book.
Yeah, I don't know where my humor comes from. You know, there's a ton of things that I find funny. Yeah, maybe not a ton now, but yeah, I don't know where it comes from.
I mean, because you actually, you edited a volume of African-American comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is... there's so much black humor, African American humor that's out there that has just been pushed aside, you know. So a person who I really love is this old vaudevillian, Burt Williams, made some silent movies, and he was a big star of the stage, you know, one of the biggest stars on Broadway's, you know, in the early 1900s, late 1800s. But he's really funny. He wrote these songs and these poems and these skits, and they're hilarious. But they're uncomfortable for people because, you know, they take people back to a time where things weren't necessarily so funny, but his stuff is funny as hell. But yeah, I mean, humor's always in the air, and it's something that I'm glad is there.
Well, from humor to the very serious business of prizes, because, of course, it's the Booker Prize. Now, we are recording this before the prize is actually announced. You're on a short list of six, one of six. It's a huge thing here in Britain. Mm. And I wonder if in America you have any sense of how massive this prize is to us.
Yeah, I think some people do. I mean, I think, you know, I work with some other writers, so they have a sense of it. And so I met Marlon James in Brooklyn, and I can't remember if he had been nominated or if he'd already won, but just in talking to him, and I saw him in Jamaica. We did this festival together, and he had just a nice glow to him, and the way that people treated him, I was like, oh yeah, this man Booker thing is a big deal, and he deserved it. And so I just got a sense from watching others around him, kind of. He was himself. Mm. And so that was like a thing that first clicked in. And then when I met my publisher and how honored she was, and even though she's been shortlisted, I guess, 2 years in a row, and she's very nervous and wants me to say the right thing and do all the right thing, all the stuff that I'm loath to do. But... But, you know, it's a big deal for her, and, you know, just this everything that's been here. And what a nice thing is, you know, doing these interviews in Australia and Ireland, you know, in India, you know, there's another international component to it. So that's, you know, something that, you know, the States is a very kind of misanthropic place in a weird way when it comes to the arts. You know, it's us and that's it a little bit, you know. So, yeah, it's definitely a big deal.
You have a precedent here. Marlon came onto the show just before he won. I really hope that it's the same for you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Paul Beattie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks.
Paul Beattie was speaking to me the day before he won the 2016 Man Booker Prize. The Sellout is published by One World. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to editor Toby Hammond. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.